The other thing that's going to be interesting too is India. I mean, once India is a lot more remote than it is now, you're going to start to see a lot more Indian digital nomads. Within 36 months, you will have employees from Twitter, Facebook, Google that will all be in your co-working space, guaranteed. Change to work since the Industrial Revolution just in the last 6 months, and no one recognizes how huge of a shift we've currently experienced.
You're listening to the Remote Explorers Podcast, a show that allows you to connect, learn, and be inspired by the stories of people who have used the power of remote work to have unconventional experiences in their lives. The podcast is hosted by Mayur and Shahzada, who are experienced and equally curious remote workers.
Welcome to another episode of the Remote Explorers Podcast. Today in the episode, we have Liam Martin with us. Liam is a pioneer and an advocate of the remote work movement for a very long time now. He's the co-founder of Time Doctor, which is a time tracking tool for remote teams. He's also been organizing world's largest conference on remote working called Running Remote. This conversation that we had with Liam, me and Mayur, it completely blew my mind and made me see the potential of location independence movement in India from a very different perspective. If you're someone who is curious to know what would be the future of remote work in India and other developing countries, listen to this episode with full attention because this is gold in audio format. We start the episode with Liam sharing the story of Fahim from Bangladesh, who has a certain type of disability and how he has managed to become the top freelancer on Fiverr and Upwork for designing. Fahim now sustains a family of 8 people through his freelance earnings. We discuss the impact of remote work in developing countries like India and also how this is the biggest revolution in the work culture since the industrial age. Liam talks about why for the environment, going remote is way better than going vegan. We also touch on the expansion of the Indian digital nomadism scene and why it is inevitable to happen. Also, we discuss the upcoming new wave of co-working, co-living spaces in India and the world. Guys, do let us know how you find our podcast. We would love to know your feedback. Please connect with us on our social media handles. I will put the links in the description of this episode. Enjoy Liam Martin on this episode of the Remote Explorers Podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Remote Explorers Podcast. I'm very excited for today's episode. We have Liam Martin with us. He is the co-founder of Time Doctor, and he's been running the biggest retreat for remote workers called Running Remote for 2018, 2019, and they did a virtual conference in 2020, which was a hit. I was there. Liam, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I'm very excited about getting in today's discussion because, as we had talked beforehand, it's very rare that I go onto a podcast about remote work. Most of the time, I have to explain to people what remote work is and also all of the craziness that's been happening the last couple of months. So hopefully we can go a little bit deeper than what we usually go.
Yeah, I think it's a pleasure for the Indian audience because our podcast is more about developing countries. And it's very important to address the topic and the potentials that remote working has for developing countries. As I remember in your 2019 conference, I was watching it on YouTube, the story of this Bangladeshi guy that you shared on the stage.
Fahim.
Yes. It was heart touching, and that makes me realize how much important you, me, and Mayur today sit, talk about it, and see the future of how it can impact developing countries in growth and bridge the gap between the urban population and the rural population.
You know, Fahim just bought a house, so he just bought a house for his entire family, which is great, and he's supporting, I believe, a family of 8 people, like. you know, grandparents, parents, all that kind of stuff. And it's funny because for those of you that don't know, just type in Fahim running remote and you'll probably find it on YouTube. It's also on Facebook too. And it's the story of my friend Fahim, who has muscular dystrophy, and he lives in Bangladesh. And him and his mother were selling handmade rugs on the streets of the capital city in Bangladesh.
Dhaka.
Right, for 6 months to get enough money for him to get a laptop. And then he taught himself design, and he's now one of the top designers on Fiverr and on Upwork, and he supports his entire family through that. And the funny thing is that whenever you hire Fahim, nowhere on his profiles does it say that he has a disability. So you're just hiring him because he's a good designer, not because he has a disability and you're offering him a handout. And he makes more than, you know, probably everyone in his town, fundamentally, which is incredibly inspiring to me. Whenever I think about my day and how stressful it might be, I think about Fahim's day and I think to myself, I'm just screwing with myself. I should really get back to work.
Yeah.
And I think this wouldn't have been possible without remote work, right?
Absolutely.
So remote
not.
Work is the driver.
Yeah. I mean, my philosophy is that remote work empowers employers and employees to find the best of each other. And that's the fundamental promise that remote work offers, which is regardless of where you're located, you know, whether you're in India or Bangladesh or you're in Canada or you're in the UK, it's the best person for the job. And I think we're actually probably right at the cusp of a second wave of globalization. And we first globalized products. And I think now we're really going to be globalizing services at a massive scale. So you're not going to see the people in San Francisco get the job just because they happen to be located in San Francisco. Most of the tech companies now have gone remote, and they've gone permanently remote. So within the next 6 to 18 months, you're going to see all of those jobs that you could have only gotten in San Francisco being offered remotely, which opens up India, as an example, as a massive market where you're going to go from a $400,000 US developer in San Francisco that works for Facebook. Facebook may offer that job, probably not for $400,000, probably for $200,000 to the Indian market. Well, $200,000 in the Indian market is absolutely amazing. And you're not going to see that brain drain get sucked out of India and go back to San Francisco. So I think it's very interesting what's going to happen. I think you're actually going to create a mass distribution of like the Silicon Valley mindset, and it's just going to go everywhere, which also is a bit of a shame because I also think it's the end of the golden age of the Silicon Valley of San Francisco. I don't think there's ever going to be a higher concentration of smart people on planet Earth than there was in San Francisco in January of 2020.
Yeah, I think it's history now. And yeah. That will be a chapter in history books all around the world.
Absolutely.
So whatever you just said, Liam, that brings me to a question that I had in my head when I was doing your research. I was going through that 2019 video, and you asked all the people sitting in the conference who is from Central America, who's from North America, who's from Africa, and the Eastern countries, India, all the map that you had on the screen, there were zero people from India.
Mm-hmm.
It was not even in the map. And as we see back after the 1991 revolution in India, globalization, privatization, and liberalization, a lot of companies from Western world outsourced India in a lot of things that Indians could do for them. Like BPO market exploded after 91 in India because they need people who could speak English, and they would charge less to those US companies. I see this is how remote work could be the game changer here. And the next conference that Running Remote does, I'm sure the percentage of Indian market, the people who are there attending those conference would really increase. So my question to you is, how do you see after the COVID scenario, how do you see the impact of remote working would help developing countries like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh?
So first off, I want to roll back to the terminology that you used in past 91. You're absolutely right. The BPO industry in India just exploded. I would probably say back-end BPO, there's no better place on planet Earth than India. Like, India dominates that particular industry. But the terminology that you used is interesting because you're talking about outsourcing. And I actually think outsourcing as a term, we should try to reorganize it or re-understand it, because I actually think it's a little bit racist now. So if I'm in Dhaka, as an example, and I work from home and I'm working on my computer, on my laptop, I'm outsourced. But if I take that exact same person and I bring them to Manhattan and I put them in a Starbucks and they're working from the same computer, they're remote, right? There's no differentiator between those two people. It's just their location. And we're starting to see if you're in a Western country, you're remote. And if you're paid more and you're in a Western country, you're remote. If you're paid less and you're in a developing country, you're outsourced. And that just doesn't make any sense. And I don't like that terminology. So I try to kind of grab it and reorganize that term whenever humanly possible. Now, the large implications with regards to India are, I mean, I think this is going to completely revolutionize India's economy. I actually think right now we're probably going to see the largest transfer of wealth from the West to developing countries. Like, if you thought 91 was big, I think this is, 91 is going to be like a speed bump in comparison to what you're going to see in the next 36 months. Because all of these large tech companies, they are all adopting remote work en masse. And not only that, large corporate is adopting remote work en masse. Siemens, which is one of the largest companies in the world, a German company, 350,000 employees, just said they're never going back to an office. That labor will then be a global, it's a global labor force. And Indians will be able to compete. Indians located in India will be able to compete on exactly the same playing field as Germans or as Brits or Canadians. So I've been on a lot of podcasts where, it's a US podcast, and I've kind of said, like, I think the United States is going to be a big loser in this process long term, because the competition is intense. There are more Indians getting graduate degrees in India than there are university graduates in the United States, right? And it's like these universities, and I've done the research, they're not second tier universities. They're just as difficult to be able to get those degrees in India as they are in the United States. So fundamentally, there is a better product in terms of labor coming out of India in comparison to the US, but because there is a little bit of racism, a little bit of sort of, well, at least pre-COVID, hey, remote work doesn't work. All of those things are getting thrown out the window now, because we've tested the assumption en masse and we've discovered that remote work does actually work, number one. And more importantly, it's actually more productive. You can get more done in less time with a remote work model, hiring, let's say, people from India versus having everyone in San Francisco, where 30% of your profit and loss statement goes towards rent.
Yeah, so interestingly, a lot of Indian companies, which I thought would never go remote, are talking about remote work as a permanent way of working. Even government of India, they have told their employees that even after the pandemic, they'll work remotely for 2 weeks in a year, which is a big jump, because if government is saying that even 2 weeks matter a lot, because government is massive. And in terms of the way India is moving forward with the connectivity and getting more people connected to the internet, taking the internet to remote locations, I feel that India has a lot to achieve or gain from the reverse brain drain.
If I just, was the government of India right now,
just a little context, Liam, to what's happening in India with the data. So just 4 years back, to get 1 gigabyte of data in India, it would cost say $2, right, with your plan. But right now, there's a company called Jio, which is owned by Reliance. They've revolutionized the spread of internet in India. Right now, we pay $7 or $8 for 3 months with every day free 2 gigabytes of data and unlimited calling. That's how cheap data has gone in India now.
Interesting. I do a lot of work in the Philippines, and their internet sucks. Like, it's one of the biggest barriers towards success. And when you look at, like, the Philippines is definitely more of a front office BPO game, right? As opposed to India, that's more of a back office BPO game, which, by the way, is more profitable. If I had a choice, I'd always be back office versus front of shop. When you see countries that have been successful in the adoption of the digitization of the economy, it absolutely perfectly connects to very cheap and easy access to high-speed internet. So if I was in control of the Indian government, I would, to a degree, actually federalize telecommunications. And I would say there are corporations that can operate inside of India. However, there are requirements that you need to be able to keep if you're actually going to operate as a telecom company. One of which would be there has to be a certain rate at which data costs, right? Like, they do an audit of what are the actual costs. There's no price gouging, and just try to distribute internet as quickly and as cheaply as humanly possible, because more people that get access. The other thing too that's quite interesting is I just signed up as a beta user for Elon Musk's new internet project. So for anyone that doesn't know, he, through SpaceX, he's launching, I think it's 20,000 satellites, low Earth orbit satellites, that are going to provide high-speed internet to everyone through satellite. And it's 500 up, 500 down, with a ping of below 20 milliseconds, which is better than the current internet that I have in Canada, significantly better. And it's going to cost me in Canada $80 per month. And I currently pay $120 per month for my internet access. I believe in developing markets, they're going to try to make it a lot cheaper. But like when you think about that, let's say everyone on planet Earth gets 500 up, 500 down. You know, you're going to be able to be in the middle of the Sahara with a little satellite dish and be able to do 4K Zoom calls with everybody. It's going to be a complete game changer. And I think the local telecom companies are not really recognizing that that's coming down the pipe, and it's coming down very quickly because they already deployed throughout North America and Canada, and they're accepting beta users right now. So I think they're going to complete their project within the next 2 years, in which case everyone on planet Earth will be able to get access to this type of service, which when you see that, that's going to just open everything up even more, right? Because now, you know, India can jump right ahead of the West, where we have fiber lines that we're laying everywhere. And so does India, obviously, but not to the infrastructure level that Canada has. India can just jump right over that and just say, yeah, okay, well, we're just going to go with satellite, and it's going to work.
Yeah. So I think in terms of connectivity, India, you know, government of India is focusing a lot on getting more villages or areas connected. And then the next step is to improve the internet speed. So I was just reading a couple of days ago in the news that they're laying out like thousands of kilometers of fiber cables in remote islands just to get them connected. And with 5G coming up, things will be even better in terms of connectivity.
Absolutely.
I remember you mentioned in one of the conferences that it's it's better to go remote than going vegan. I want you to talk a little about that.
Better carbon footprint. You save more carbon. That's it.
Yeah.
So I measure my environmental impact by carbon. I just had my first child, 5 weeks old, and one of my biggest kind of thoughts that went through my mind with regards to having children was, what is the carbon footprint of that child, right? If we all want to be responsible human beings and try to make sure that we are at least kind of deadening the curve of climate change, you have to think about those types of things. So when I was running the calculations, and I actually did it just directly, there are carbon calculators that you can run. And I basically said, okay, well, I don't need a second car. So I got rid of my second car. And then in this carbon calculator, it had the cost of heating and basically like heating and cooling an office, right? Because a lot of people, like, even if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you've still got to heat and cool the office that you go to only from 9 to 5. And you're also heating and cooling your home, which you're not in from 9 to 5. So it's kind of an interesting, stupid model. And it's about, if I remember correctly, the amount of carbon that you save is, I think it's 60% better than going vegan, if I remember correctly, per year, right? So, you know, for those that want to sit down to a big, you know, chicken dinner or something like that, and you feel uncomfortable ethically about it, go remote. It's going to be definitely a much better saving from a carbon perspective.
And especially in a developing country like India, where there are 1.3 billion people, it's surprising to see that carbon footprint conversation is not a mainstream conversation here in the corporate culture. The big corporations are not really talking about it, like they are a little shy about it. So I was reading one of the datas which said most of the pollution that is caused in India is because of the top 100 companies. So if those 100 companies go remote, there'll be a lot less carbon footprint.
Especially in the south for India, right? Like if you look at southern India, a lot of southern India is going to go if all of the projections are true and water levels go up by 20 feet. Southern India is in very, very big trouble. So anything that India could do to be able to reduce that, I completely agree with you. The problem is, like, it's a classic tragedy of the commons argument, which is a philosophical argument that there's a common good, right, which is our environment, and there's no cost to me as an individual damaging that environment, right? There's no cost associated with that because it's not an automatic feedback loop. But unfortunately, it actually does. If everyone does it, right, the tragedy of the commons, the common land being taken, eventually everyone is going to destroy it, which to me, I mean, this isn't really about remote work, but I think there has to be a mechanism for us to price out carbon in some context to be able to make sure that we're managing that properly, because in my opinion, we're definitely on a trajectory that's going to be very bad within the next 50 years. Just yesterday or this week sometime, they announced that there was a new warmest temperature ever recorded on planet Earth, which was, I believe, 58.4 degrees Celsius. I mean, it's getting pretty bad. And even up in Canada, we're feeling the effects much more than people that are closer to the center of the planet, simply because there's more variation in temperature. And we've seen just up in here in Canada, the maple syrup season, which is a major part of our economy, has moved 1 month in the past 20 years. So the maple syrup runs 1 month earlier than what it did 20 years ago. And we've never seen that before. It's unprecedented. So there's really weird things happening to the planet. And I think if we're not thinking about this up front, it could be a major issue. And remote work could be absolutely one of those tools that could, you know, move us approximately about 30% in the right direction, which is not all the way, right? There's still a major part that large corporations need to be able to handle. There's another company that I've been looking at investing in that is really looking at new and innovative ways of processing cement, which is actually one of the largest carbon footprint costs on the planet, which you wouldn't think is necessarily a big issue, but it actually is. It's probably, that's where I believe 12% of all carbon is processed. It's just literally making cement. So there are these little fundamental things that we need to solve, and it's not as complicated as you would think, but because the people that have most of the power on planet Earth, and those are the people that, like, I can't even get into that room with those 1,000 people that are the most powerful people on planet Earth, right? Like, my friends that are much wealthier than me, they may be able to get into that room, but I haven't even been able to get into that room yet. Those are the people that are in control of everything, and they could actually change things, but they don't want to because they've got a really good situation set up right now, which is maybe a little bit conspiratorial, but definitely true.
So one benefit of remote work that I can foresee is, you know, when it's winter in Canada, go to Mexico and save the heating costs.
As Bali, I like Bali in the winters, actually, Canadian winters. Costa Rica is really good. Mexico is really good. I like to go to Barcelona as well, even though it's a little bit cold. It is still nice enough. I've never been to Goa, actually. Our company retreat was supposed to be in Goa, but it got canceled by COVID, which was really unfortunate. So it's been on my list for a while. I want to go down and check it out. But yeah, I mean, there's so many places that you can travel to. And the other thing that's going to be interesting too is India. I mean, once India is a lot more remote than it is now, you're going to start to see a lot more Indian digital nomads. I think it's an inevitability, particularly, I mean, one of the big barriers is obviously making sure that those passports are really great and you can just go anywhere without actually applying for a visa, but it's going to start to happen. I think within the next 36 months, co-working spaces and co-living spaces are going to 10x, so much so that I'm buying a co-working space right now because they're so cheap. But if you can just cash flow them to the point in which COVID is over and the vaccine happens, conservatively, there are probably 500,000 people that make more than $100,000 a year that are now allowed to work remotely. And why would I stay in San Francisco or New York or Chicago or London or Toronto when I can go to Goa and live in a huge villa, right, for what was the price of a one-bedroom apartment in Toronto, as an example?
Yeah, so Liam, you mentioned about, you know, more Indian digital nomads coming into picture. Mm-hmm. So interestingly, I run a co-working, co-living place in Goa called Nomad Town. Before the lockdowns and before COVID hit us, 90% of my members were foreigners, because Indian digital nomad as a class was very niche. And then now, after the lockdowns are over, my place is full of Indians who are digital nomads, first-time digital nomads and experiencing this lifestyle. And I think it's just going to grow.
That's really cool. I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, when you see in 36 months, mark it in your calendar, 36 months from now, you're going to see a complete reorganization of the labor market. You're going to see a whole bunch of Indians that are going to get access to jobs that they would have never thought possible 36 months ago. You're going to see a whole bunch of Indians that are going, that are becoming digital nomads because they have the money to be able to do it. They have that extra disposable income. And you're also probably going to see small ecosystems being set up throughout India just based off of this top-tier talent that used to go to San Francisco that is now staying in India. An interesting fact that someone gave me that I have to confirm, but I think it's true. 53% of tech companies in San Francisco that have more than 1,000 employees are immigrants. So they were 53% of tech companies that have 1,000 or more employees. Those tech companies imported 53% of their labor force to San Francisco. That's not happening anymore, right? Those people are going to be staying where they're located, and they're going to be paid way more money than what they were going to be able to get in their own local market, but then they'll be able to inject that knowledge and that money back into the local economy. So I'm very excited about what's going to be happening in the next 36 months.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just excited about what the future holds. In fact, we are also using remote work to, you know, drive some social change. So Shehzada, I, and some other team members, we are working on a project called Program Panchayat. So the idea is there are people working remotely, they can base themselves anywhere. So why should not they go to a village, spend 40 hours a week working, 10 hours a week educating the villagers on latest technology, or doing mobile payments, or using social media effectively, and then also spend 10 hours a week learning farming from them, or learning sustainable ways of living from them.
Oh, very cool.
So the idea is to, you know, bridge the urban-rural gap and make villages future-ready, make the cities more sustainable.
I would probably say, and I have never been to India myself, but from what I've heard from people that do live in India, the cities are very tight, right? Like, it's very, very dense. And you'll see that same, if I can have high-speed internet and be in a village of 2,000 people and live in a really nice home there, done. Like, sign me up. I do not want to be in a city of 5 million, 10 million people where I have a 500-square-foot, you know, postage stamp. Even just in terms of working, right? Like, it's going to be very, very difficult. We have some team members that are located in India, and we've been, one of the requirements that we have is you have to have a separate space to work that you can like close the door, because we think that's absolutely critical towards success in remote work. And it's just, it's so much more expensive, right? In those major cities versus villages, especially if you can get high speed internet out there, it's going to be killer. No one will want to go back to the old model.
Remote working could be used as a very nice bridge, because there's a lot of gap between the rural population and the urban population. There are people whose average salary may be $200 a month living in a big city, driving a rickshaw, and that person is living in a city, eating in a city, have those expenses. So, but his family is living in a rural village. Their family income might be $100 a month. And if he goes right now for a family member of a person who's earning $100 for the whole month, he needs to go to a city, spend a lot of money on education in a physical college just before 2020, and then apply for jobs and then be able to go from $100 a month to say $400 a month. But now the scenario has changed. You can get the best education from across the world from your laptop, and you can get a job in the best paying corporations in the world, sitting in the village that you are, only if you have the right infrastructure, internet, for that matter.
And I think everyone has the same internet. You know, everyone has access to the same internet. It's just a matter of how you are exposed to using it properly. And that will drive the change.
That's one of those things that I find hilarious is, you're right, everyone has the same internet. I remember back in the 90s, everyone was talking about how the internet is just like, the internet is going to completely revolutionize education, and we're going to have all of these fantastic academic pursuits that we're going to apply for internet. And the vast majority of the internet is Netflix and cat memes and porn right now, versus like actual, right, real work. And so, I think the infrastructure play is the one that's just so important. Get the internet in there, even if it's not used for the intent that it should be used for, theoretically. Once you deploy it, you're going to see money out of all of those particular areas. So, I mean, the average BPO worker in India What do they make per month, would you say?
I think 300 to 400.
300 to 400, yeah.
So to me, right, if I'm a worker in the, you know, in a rural area, and let's say it's 300 to 400 in the city, but literally just put me rural, let me work in my rural area and pay me 200, that's still double what I'm getting paid in my own local village. I mean, that's going to be a revolution in itself, because that talent is there, right? Like, the talent is available. You just need to be able to really kind of extract it in the right way, right? And we just don't even have the machinery in place to be able to extract it properly. And, you know, remote work has absolutely been, it's kind of almost been like the genie's out of the bottle at this point. I'm getting so many people that are coming to me saying, yeah, it looks like they're just as productive, if not more productive than they were before. And so I actually think it's like a push-pull. So I think on one end, the employer is going to say, well, everyone was just as productive as they were before. 30% of my profit and loss statement is going towards an office right now. Why would I pay that 30%? I can put that 30% into user acquisition or literally into my own pocket, fundamentally, at least for the short term. On the other side, the bottom-up approach, the employee that just spent 6 months to probably 12 months working remotely, that's now being asked to be brought back inside of the office, they're going to say, well, weren't my numbers solid when I was working from home? You already told me that my numbers were good. We just got 4 quarters of really good numbers. Why do I need to go back to an office? My life was a lot easier when I was, you know, at home. And now it's even easier because COVID is over. So I can get childcare for my kids. You know, I can do the things that I love the terminology work from home, because it's not remote work. Like, work from home is, there's a scary virus outside that's going to kill me, so I can't go to a coffee shop or a co-working or co-living space, anything like that. But once we get a vaccine and it's distributed, it's going to be a complete game changer, because all of those people are going to actually feel the real remote work, which is the ability to just kind of, I see a future in India where a small town of 10,000 people can have a couple co-working spaces in it. And maybe they're even co-working spaces that are actually like corporate co-working spaces, like a large, you know, a large BPO just sets up a small office of, let's say, 30 people, you know, 30 spots. And then you just walk 10 minutes to work every day, as opposed to commuting in an hour and a half. That's a much better version of the future for me. It's better for workers. It's better for employers, right? It's cheaper for employers. It's a higher level of kind of life satisfaction for employees.
And better for planet.
Oh, yeah. Well, and we don't end up underwater within the next 50 years, which I'm very concerned about, because in Canada, you know, as I said before, it freaks people out when the maple syrup runs a month early. That's just terrifying. I have a couple friends of mine that run a maple syrup farm. So that's why I keep harking on that stuff.
So interestingly, some of the local governments, they're launching policies to attract their own residents who have settled abroad and working for big corporations. Now they're attracting them to come back and work near home. They call it work near home. So they're setting up small offices.
I actually think, so I have a thesis, and I don't know if you guys agree with this, but you might be able to kind of, you know, the context. I think WeWork was like 3 years too early. What do you think? Because so I don't like the fundamentals of WeWork. I think they were massively overvalued. I actually have a video that when they were going IPO, I broke down what their costs were versus other BPO network, or sorry, not BPOs, co-working networks that I've seen. And I was like, listen, in reality, this company's worth like $3 billion. And they were IPOing at 40.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, IWG was at the similar scale.
Exactly. That's one of the exact company that I compared to, right? So I was looking at the context there and I was like, it makes no sense. And I thought they were a technology company. But with all of that said, the promise of WeWork, at least to me, was an AWS for physical space, right? So like a cloud server for physical space. So we had, I believe, 5 WeWork like spots that floated throughout the entire global network. So anyone in our company could actually go into a WeWork. They all had logins so that they could go into a physical WeWork, and you couldn't log more than 5 people in per day. So you could go to any location on planet Earth. That is a business model that is totally going to blow up post-COVID. There's going to be a model. There's going to be a winner-takes-all type of model where it's like, I'm the McDonald's of co-working. And you can go in, you can get good internet, you can have a relatively easy place to work, you can have a quiet place to work. And there's going to be one of those in every major city on planet Earth. It doesn't currently exist right now, like, you know, because WeWork obviously was a complete disaster, and it should have, like, it definitely should have blown up. It wasn't managed well, but I don't know your guys' thoughts on that, but I just kind of see that as I wish. And the other problem too is no one's going to invest in that type of play because SoftBank lost his shirt on WeWork. So no one's going to want to say, yeah, let's invest $5 billion into this same model that completely collapsed a couple years beforehand. But it is the model now. Like, you should be building it now to be able to build the McDonald's of WeWork in the next 2 to 3 years, because the Twitters, the Googles, the Salesforces, the Shopifys of the world, they're going to need to put their labor into spaces, and they're going to need reliability. Knowing, I know if I go into, you know, co-working space X, I will get this level of internet. They will be able to have a phone call that's quiet, right? Like, these are requirements that I have as a remote employer. And if I want my team to go nomadic, or if I allow my team to go nomadic, I need that type of infrastructure. But I keep thinking about that. I think about that almost once a day, which is like, that is a Google level idea that someone will do, and I don't know who's going to do it.
Yeah, if you invest money in me, I will do it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you can convince somebody to invest $1 billion in you, I will put in $100,000, no problem, because I want a piece of that for sure. Like, there's going to be a company that does that, and I don't know who it is right now because I can't even understand where that ecosystem exists. I don't know if you guys know Hubud, Steve, yeah, who runs. Yeah. So, I mean, I was telling Steve this, and I think he's aligned on, me and him have the same perspective. I was trying to convince Steve to do it, but he's not interested in doing something like that. But it'll be somebody for sure.
Yeah. I have a slightly different take on that.
Okay.
I feel that the future is smaller communities, independent communities, and maybe there would be an aggregator who would make sure that the experience is managed well.
What about Croissant? Is it Croissant? There's a couple apps right now that are literally like app aggregators of co-working spaces. Yeah, Croissant. Yeah. So like, you know, I'm seeing right now, there's all of these co-working spaces, and you can just buy a discounted seat for the day on the app, right? And you have a membership to it. That's an interesting play. There's a couple other companies in the space that are doing that, but I think fundamentally, I don't know. I think so, because, not to necessarily go too deep on co-working and co-living, the margins are actually relatively thin. That's one of the major reasons why WeWork collapsed, is they assumed that they were a technology company and that they were able to put, for some reason, twice the amount of people in the same square footage, which, like, their only explanation, if you read their IPO docs, is because of technology, we'll be able to put twice as many, we'll be able to charge twice as much per square foot, which just doesn't make any sense. Like, they were going to use some type of advanced scheduling AI so that you could put people in the same space at the same time, but it was complete vaporware. There is such a small margin on co-working and co-living that there would probably, maybe an aggregator is the way to go, but either an aggregator or some other company, almost like a Google, that knows I want to own the attention of that entire ecosystem. So I'll buy it at a loss, almost like an Android play, where I know I now have the eyeballs of 100 million workers. And at any point, actually a company like LinkedIn, probably that's an example of a company that would probably just build a whole bunch of co-working spaces just to do it.
Just a little off track. Do you think it's a, it's a good idea to create another big corporation like Amazon, Facebook, Google? And
I mean, well, it will. Is it a good idea? I don't know. That's, I think you have to talk about the ethics of whether or not a big corporation like that is something that even the world needs right now. But will it happen? Absolutely. If you think right now that those are like the winners of the game, you don't understand how companies, like, you don't even understand what's going to be happening in the next 6 months, which is we have currently experienced the largest change to work since the Industrial Revolution just in the last 6 months. And no one recognizes how huge of a shift we've currently experienced. And neither do corporations. So even someone that could capitalize on that in an interesting way will be a trillion-dollar corporation. I actually think right now, when we talk about like Time Doctor, which is the SaaS company that we run, which is a time tracking tool for remote teams, we historically have only been taking advantage of the secret of remote work, which is I can have the same amount of labor, same salary, I can extract the same amount of labor for a 30% discount. Just that's it. Like end of sentence, right? If I can extract labor at a 30% discount to any of my competitors, then I can put those extra 30 cents on the dollar into user acquisition, which is why we dominate the market. That's it, right? Like if you look at any of our competitors that are in an office, we have built a better mousetrap. We're just better at, you know, and it's not because we're smarter. It's not because our talent is better. It's because we can impact the market at a 30% discount in comparison to our competitors. So I can pay 30% more for a customer than my competitor because I've just structured, you know, my labor practices in this way. That advantage is actually now disappearing. Within the next 18 months, I expect that I will no longer have that advantage in the market because all of my competitors will jump to that model. Even with Running Remote, which was a conference about remote work, it's hilarious because when we first started Running Remote, it was about remote work. Digital nomads were not invited. If you did not manage a remote team, it's not the conference for you. So we set the price at $1,000 a head. We purposely set the price at a very high amount, specifically because we did not want digital nomads to come. We were designing the product just for the remote worker, or I guess the remote employer, not necessarily the remote worker or the digital nomad. And now, and this is kind of, I guess, tantamount to just the moving market, all of the conferences that were about digital nomadism are now moving towards remote work. There's two conferences that I know of actually that are completely rebranding themselves, like changing their domain. Because they're saying, well, the digital nomad space has been such an exciting space. Everyone talks about digital nomadism because it's a sexy concept, but in reality, it's like 1% of remote work right now. But it'll 5X in the next 36 months for sure, right? If you're building a product for digital nomadism, now's the time to build it and to get it out into the market. But 95% of people are still going to be remote workers, which is someone that works from home, they don't travel, they work in their home office or they work in a co-working space. That's the type of worker that I'm trying to optimize for and trying to figure out what other products do they need, because you quite literally went from, I would say probably 100 million remote workers pre-COVID to probably 2 to 3 billion right now that are working remotely it's nuts. Like, they don't even know what they need right now, which is crazy. And I don't even know what to sell them, but I know we can sell them a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah, if you're listening to this podcast right now and you know what that product is, please call me, because I really want to kind of figure out, or if you're even doing something like that, I'd love to get to know you a little bit deeper, because it's like, there's going to be a Google that comes out of this. There's going to be a couple Googles that come out of it. You just have to kind of recognize where is that intention going. And it's definitely in remote work.
Liam, this podcast is about the stories of remote workers. The okay. Your journey from being in education, then starting staff.com, then starting Time Doctor, to what you're doing right now. Give our audience a little context to what was the inspiration, how this transformation has happened over the years from education to running remote now.
Sure. So, I mean, Time Doctor, which was it's time tracking tool for remote teams. The reason why it came together was I was running an online tutoring company before. So I was teaching at McGill University in graduate school. And for those of you that don't know, when you enter graduate school, you usually end up teaching the first year classes just because professors are too expensive. So they pay people like me minimum wage to be able to teach all the first year students. And I remember teaching my very first class. I thought it was going to go great. I ended up with about half of that class quitting my class before the end of the semester. And I got some of the worst reviews, lecturer reviews in the history of the department. And the department had been in operation for 121 years. So not very good. And I remember going into my supervisor's office and saying, I don't think I'm very good at this. And he said, no, you're not. And then I said, okay, so what do you think I should do? He's like, you got to get pretty good at this teaching thing for the next 20-ish years before you get to do anything fun. So either figure out what to do with your life on the lecturing side or figure out a new way to work. And so 4 weeks later, I threw a master's thesis under his door. I quit my PhD and I was out into the real world, turned that into a tutoring company. Problem I had in the tutoring company was I was not able to measure specifically how long a tutor worked with a student. And this entire tutoring company was virtual. So we were doing Skype calls basically with students. And so we'd bill a student for 10 hours. The student would come to me and say, hey, I didn't work with my tutor for 10 hours. I worked with him for 5. I have to go to the tutor and I'd say, hey, did you work with this student for 10 hours or 5 hours? And he'd say, I billed for 10. Of course I did 10 hours. So I'd end up having to refund the student for 5 hours and pay the tutor for the full 10. This was destroying the business. So that was really kind of what came about with regards to Time Doctor. How can you adequately measure how long a remote worker does a particular task for you? Now it's kind of evolved into really focusing on productivity. So where are you putting your time and how can you deploy your time more productively into what you're doing? So context being like, a lot of the times when we work with large companies, we can actually tell them, hey, you know what? It looks like the average work week for your team is 42 hours and 32 minutes. And it looks to me like if you reduce that work week to 26 hours, you're actually going to get more done. Like you'll make more money if people work less time. All those types of insights we have because we have the largest second by second work database on the planet. And then running remote obviously was simply just the further exploration of the other problem that we had, which was we were in Boracay in the Philippines at one of our company team retreats. And we had about 100 people in the company at that point. And we were trying to figure out how to get to 200 people, 300 people, 400 people. So we started Googling stuff on like how to build large remote teams. And there was almost nothing there back in 2016, 2017. Like we're talking nothing. There was like how to hire a virtual assistant, how to outsource, but there was nothing about building a remote team, remote culture. And I knew that there were companies that were doing remote culture very well, but they were very small. And so we thought, well, let's just do a conference on this. And going back to the discussion that we had previously, no one had really done a conference on remote work. A whole bunch of people had done conferences on digital nomadism, but digital nomadism is more like travel hacking, you know, which locations are the coolest. That's the kind of subject matter that you would learn at a digital nomad conference, not how do you scale from 0 to 3,000 remote support reps in 2 years, as an example. Like, what's the journey look like for that? And so we said to ourselves, well, we really want to learn that. We don't know whether others want to learn that, but we know we really want to learn that. So it was a ready, fire, aim philosophy where we just said, let's just get a venue for $100,000 and let's get some of my friends that are connected to remote work to come and speak at the event. And worst case scenario, if no one comes, we'll at least learn something. And so we ended up having about 500 people come to the last one. A little over 500 people actually came to the last one. So good group, good community. The one in Austin was going to be 1,000 people, which was going to be very exciting. And I think that once we restart again, we'll probably be able to have 5,000-10,000 people come to an event like this. Again, my thesis is let's educate people as much as possible, and then hopefully they will be happy enough that they'll be willing to pay for, you know, the physical event. But yeah, I mean, that's my story from beginning to end. And fundamentally through that entire vein, it's remote work, right? So our mission statement as a company is we want to empower people to work remotely. We want to proliferate remote work. So that comes to a time tracking tool like Time Doctor, a conference like Running Remote, or, you know, me wanting to buy a co-working space. It all feeds into that same thesis.
Because a lot of Indian companies are going remote for the first time.
Yeah.
They're still figuring out how to deal with this. So what are the three things you would advise to companies going remote for the first time?
So first thing is communication. Communication happens on purpose in remote teams. There is no serendipitous conversations that occurs inside of remote teams. And this is a big thing for on-premise companies, which is what we call physically located companies that are all inside of an office, to understand. So there's no coffee, you know, coffee shop or coffee pot talk or water cooler talk or anything like that. So you have to schedule everything, and your communication has to be very, very precise. So documentation has to be very precise. If you're in a remote team, generally asynchronous forms of communication are going to be a lot more effective than synchronous forms of communication. Like right now, we're actually seeing our videos on this tool that we're using, Squadcast, and you're listening to us on a podcast, but right now we're communicating synchronously and you're listening to this podcast asynchronously, meaning you can choose when to consume this content or this information, as opposed to synchronously where you'd have to be on live to be able to consume the content. So that's the first one, is communication on purpose. Get your communication solid. Learn how to write emails properly. Learn how to kind of communicate asynchronously. The second thing is process documentation, which is a lot more boring, but absolutely critical towards the success of any company that's more than 50 employees that's remote right now, almost has to have some form of process documentation in place. Otherwise, they will not succeed. So what does that mean? Well, it's taking all of the information that you have, writing it down, refining it, digitizing it, and putting it into some type of cloud infrastructure, right? So there's a paid tool called Trainual, which is pretty good, trainual.com. You can check that out. You can even just start with Google Docs, which is essentially free, which is a cloud account. So you just put all of your information in Google Docs and then put it in a Google Drive. One of the other ones that I would suggest you check out is gitlab.com/handbook. And that is all of GitLab's remote process documents, and it's completely open source. I think it's 3,200 pages, and they talk about absolutely everything under the sun connected to remote work. So you can take that information, and Dimitri, who's the co-founder and CTO of the company, encourages people to steal it. So literally grab it, steal it, start your own GitLab repo, and just put all your documentation up there, and then just edit it for your own, you know, processes. So the reason why process documentation is so important is because people work virtually. So when you are in person, you can explain things to people in a much easier way than when someone is virtual, right? So you can't do it synchronously. So you need to be able to communicate that information asynchronously, which is basically process documentation. So we have in the company, absolutely everything you could possibly think of is documented. We even have how you sign your emails as a process document, because one of our team members is quite religious and put a Bible verse in her signature. And we had someone who was an atheist that got very angry at us because there was a Bible verse and he felt like it was infringing his rights. So now we have processes for all of those types of things. The third thing that I would probably touch on, I mean, number one and two are absolutely the most important things that you can do. I'd probably say the third one is just get your tools in place, right? Get your stack, your remote tech stack all set up. So where do you record this information, all these processes? Do you use a tool like Trainual, Google Docs? You know, do you communicate through email primarily? Do you communicate through Zoom? Do you communicate through Skype? Where are those pieces? Do you communicate through Slack? And for anyone that knows remote teams, they probably know all those tools. But I like to think about the remote work stack in the hierarchy of communication that exists inside of remote teams. So to me, in-person beats video, video beats audio, audio beats instant messaging, and instant messaging beats email. So yeah, as you move up the track, you become more synchronous. As you move down the track, you become more asynchronous. And all of those pieces of information or that way of communicating has a place, but it is entirely should be supported through your technology stack. So as an example, if I have more than 10 messages that go back and forth on Slack, and we're not figuring something out, I click the button on Slack to be able to set up a Zoom call, and everyone is pushed towards a Zoom call very quickly and easily so that we can spend 2 minutes not getting bothered anymore and back into flow state and discuss that issue and say, okay, well, what is the actual problem? Let's solve it. Let's sit down and figure out what we need to do next. Okay, we figured out a solution. Great. Go back to the Slack channel and then actually write down what our solution was from that call. That's about it, I think. Yeah, those would be my top three. there's 28,000 things that you could do inside of remote teams. But if you knock those three out, you're probably doing better than 90% of remote teams that are out there right now.
How do you develop the team bonding or rapport between team members?
I don't know. So I have a ton of ideas. We have a ton of things that we've tried. It's hard, man. I would say, so we tried a couple months ago, we bought a whole bunch of Oculus Quests, which are like the VR goggles that have the computer on board. So it's a completely wireless experience. And then we tried to do all of our meetings for that one department in virtual reality. Complete failure. Technology isn't ready yet. We do video game afternoons every week. So each department will kind of just play video games. And the only requirement that we have is there's some type of audio link that happens while they're playing those games so that you can play Counter-Strike, you can play a strategy game, whatever you want, as long as people are talking. We have monthly AMAs. So I just did the last one last night at about 7 o'clock in the morning, which is an Ask Me Anything. So me and my co-founder, Rob, we jump on, and if you have any questions, we answer them during that AMA. We also obviously do company retreats every year when COVID isn't happening. I still think that that's a really important piece of the pie, but it's not absolutely critical to the entire pie working. So I think you can have a team that never meets in person. My friend Amir, who runs a company called Doist, he has told me about someone that they have never seen his face. He's never been on an audio call before. He only communicates through email and through instant messaging. And he's been working for the company for 6 years and he's one of their best developers. You know, it's like you can make it work. He's weird, obviously. Like that's a weird situation. But those types of things can work inside of remote teams. And the culture is clear. You just need to be able to optimize for the way that those workers want to engage with you know, with who you are. And I think also too, it's important to communicate in your culture, not just like what we stand for, but what hill we'll die on. So I think about it not as like what, you know, oh yeah, we believe in this mission. We, you know, it's like anyone can say that, but we have a whole bunch of things that we will not do, which people have asked us to do, which we would have made a lot more money on, but it goes against the mission of the company, right? Like features that are specifically designed for on-premise office work, we don't do because we're a tool for remote work. So we optimize for remote work. There's plenty of other tools on the market that you can go to that are competitors of ours that are going to do a better job. We're just not about that. We're about remote work. Those are the types of things that you need to communicate very clearly to everyone that works inside of the company so that they know what they're on board for, and you just don't screw it up. And then if you do something that goes against the mission statement of the company, you change, you do a course correction very quickly. And a lot of those can be quite painful. We ended up having someone on our team make a really bad move that, and this person was really good at their job, but it resulted in the mission statement of the company being damaged, and we had to let that person go. And it was actually one of the worst, like it made no sense economically for us to do it, but because it goes against what we stand for as a company, we had to let that person go. And those are really hard decisions to make in the short term, but they absolutely produce dividends in the long term because the people in the company know at least what you stand for. That was way too long, but like, yeah, that's my general answer.
We are glad that you are here with us today. Thank you so much for joining us. Mayur.
Thanks, Liam. It was really wonderful. I'm sure a lot of companies, a lot of managers listening to this, they'll be inspired to manage their teams in a different way and look at remote work not as a replacement of office, but as a whole new way of working. So thank you very much for that.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's very rare that I get to talk deeply about remote work, so I appreciate it. And I think I made a couple kind of projections. 36 months from now, XYZ is going to happen. Why don't you have me back in 3 years? And then we can see whether or not all of my theories actually work their way out.
I'm sure we'll meet in Goa before that. NomadGov is waiting for you.
For sure. So. Yeah. Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it. Yeah. I had a ton of fun.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Liam. Thank you, Mayur. This is Remote Explorers, where we listen to stories of people who have used the power of remote work to have larger impact in their own lives and the lives of others.